Okay, hi everybody. Thank you for joining me again with my friend. And my friend this time is a very special friend. I'm going to read a little bit about him and then we'll schmooze. Is that okay with you, my friend?
I'm a schmoozer.
He's a schmoozer. Well, my friend is an American film director, television director, theater director. He has worked on some of the most famous television projects in the last, 20, 30 years?
40.
Shows like 40 years. 40 years. Shows like Perfect Stranger, Full House, Family Matters. He's directed, among others, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Second Sight, and Fat Albert. We'll talk about where he was born. I know where he was born. He was born in Brooklyn. We used to need a visa to get from the Bronx to Brooklyn in those days. And what I didn't know was that your father was a cantor.
My father was a cantor when he came to America, correct.
And that you grew up in an Orthodox environment. You went to James Madison High School. His Broadway credits include Shenandoah, Dance With Me, Esther, George Gershwin Alone, from Broadway. He was involved very much with the off-Broadway movement at La Mama, which I remember very well. And I'm just going to mention a few of the television pilots which he directed, which eventually all became successful series. I'm going to mention things like, starting in 1977, Busting Loose, Mork and Mindy, The Ted Knight Show, Laverne and Shirley, Bosom Buddies, The Odd New Odd Couple, Perfect Strangers, Full House, Mego, Family Matters, A Jamie Foxx Show, Love Boat, Two of a Kind, Two and a Half Men, Girls Meet World, Richie Rich, Casey Undercover, Fuller House. Those are only a few. So I'm talking about my friend. What is your name again?
I'm so confused now.
It's confusing. His name is Joel Zwick. Joel, thank you for joining me. How are you, my dear friend?
Very good. You know, being very smart, being very isolated, behaving, have to behave. There's no choice. I don't have options.
Well, you know, that's the thing I was going to ask you, since we are still in this pandemic. It's been going on for like 4 months. We've been very careful as well. I'm kind of frustrated because I just, you know, I see it's going to last for a long time. Mm-hmm. And how do we get used? How are you coping? How do we get used to a new way? We're basically talking about a new way of life.
But to some degree, you've already accomplished one thing. You've created a podcast for yourself to maintain and get some contact with old friends who could basically schmooze with you. So you've chosen one path already that is within the reign of this world that's being created around us right now.
Yeah, well, ironically, sometimes, you know, some tragedies also somehow bring after them some positive aspects, and this is one of them, I guess. We wouldn't have been able to do this on a regular basis.
Now,
we'd have to bring a camera crew, we'd have to make an appointment, we'd have to go to your place or my place.
Right.
And here we are, you know, we can talk to the world. We can basically talk to anyone in the world. So when we were born, it was unheard of. It was Dick Tracy. Remember Dick
That's
Tracy?
Essentially it, yes. Yeah.
He had a watch. And now we have
computers on our wrist.
It's crazy. It's absolutely
crazy. You're right, but there are advantages that this new world will present, and those who are the most forthcoming and inventive of their generation will find a way to manipulate that new world and to make it work for them.
And how do you think it's going to affect and change, obviously it has to, our media?
Live theater is in real trouble. It's going to be very hard for a while to do live theater. However, I'm pulling it off with our friend Hershey Felder, who introduced us essentially.
Right.
Hershey, now he's in Italy getting prepared to do a visual presentation of the show Beethoven. And he did Berlin 2 weeks ago. And he's now got a whole circuit of theaters. There's 19 of them now who send out the information about his casting, his simultaneous, you know, sending out this particular thing, and they subscribe to their subscribers, and they make money. So it's a way of funding these theaters. Hershey gets a piece of the action, and he's got a new career. He's got eight more shows that he can do the same way and get an audience for, make more money than he was making in a theater playing eight shows a week.
Right.
Because he knows he ain't getting back on a stage at least for another year to a year and a half.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's bills to be paid. There are priorities.
Look, I consider that we are lucky. We are blessed that we live in a community like you do, like I do. We are, thank God, not dependent on a daily or weekly income right now.
That's right. We basically have enough put away to get through this at this particular point, no question about it.
But what bothers me and what hurts me is all our friends in the industry, the young people, especially theatrical people, dancers, actors, choreographers, directors, who have now been unemployed for the last 5 months, and New York Broadway is not going to reopen this year at all.
No, it will not. No.
I was talking to Manny Eisenberg last week, and Manny thinks that many theaters will not come back at all.
I think that's a feasible.
Won't even be able to come back.
Yeah, I think it's very feasible.
All these kids, you know, the thousands who come every year
with the dreams of making it on Broadway.
Yeah, and so, you know, I was reading in the Sunday Times, they were bringing back the play Coming Out, is it called?
Okay.
About the baseball team.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
It had been done in the early 2000s, and they cast a wonderful bunch of young actors in it, and one of them was writing that he finally, after so many years of trying, he finally got cast in a Broadway show, and they started rehearsals.
And oh, no.
And all of a sudden, this tragedy happened, and he had to go back to his home in Jersey. He can't even go back to his waiter's job because the restaurant where he was
it's
working
closed. Oh,
is
yeah,
closed.
No. I can't think about it.
It's very heartbreaking,
but you're right. As far as we go, we are on the lucky side of this whole thing. It's not so painful for me to self-isolate. I have a big backyard with a swimming pool and that kind of stuff. So I have plenty of space back there, but that's not everybody. But I'm very pleased. I'm very blessed, actually. Blessed is a good word for it.
So since I don't have a big backyard with a swimming pool, I guess you can invite me after this to come and swim in your pool, right?
Yeah, as long as you have to basically spend 2 weeks in my driveway.
Before I can.
Before
and then I have, to swim,
into my backyard.
I have to swim with a mask.
And you have to swim with a mask.
With a mask.
But other than that, I see no particular problem, you know.
Well, you know, you were mentioning Hershey, God bless him. I think he's also it's something that I guess maybe something we all should think about, because from what I understand, you subscribe to the broadcast.
Correct.
And it's $50 per household.
It's for Beethoven, it's 55. It was 50 for Berlin. It's gone up to 55 because I think he's adding to it a piano prize. He's having any kids who want to submit 3 or 4 5-minute little Beethoven piece. 5 will be chosen out of those, and the audience who watches Beethoven will get a chance to pick the winner, who gets $25,000.
And well, you know, when you think about it, if you go to a theater today, or you can't today, but when you used to go and see a show, it may have been $50 per individual.
Person.
Now, if a family is sitting at home, you know, 5, 6 people can gather, and for $10 a person, you're watching a show. So that may be the direction we're going in.
Well, certainly they think that the movies will go in that direction, but there's something eventually about live theater, about putting living beings on a stage who are making something happen in the moment, and you are a part of that. It's quite something.
Joel, you know,
it'll always come back. There'll always be that connection.
I always have said, you know, I started when I was 7 years old in this business.
No.
I just turned 75. So I've been in this business a long time. And from the first moment I went on stage, I realized that it's a love affair between an actor and an audience.
Totally.
We don't exist without an audience. An actor is nothing without an audience. That's what we're there for. I mean, if you're a shoemaker and you don't
you can sit
at home and make a pair of shoes. If you're a watchmaker, you can fiddle with your watch and create something.
But performers have to be able to get out there and perform in front of somebody.
In front, yes.
Not simply, they do it. I mean, we were able to shoot and get serious plays, when they used to do Playhouse 90, for crying out loud. They were doing serious drama that was meaningful by some of the best writers of the day, and yet we were viewing them on television as opposed to, but the actors still were able to create a world amongst themselves, because part of it is who they relate to on stage is very important too. That chemistry is what creates the energy that, invades the audience and kind of gets them enraptured by the whole thing. But you're right, but it's going to take some time. And I just hope the next generation is smart enough to jump on the bandwagon, create the bandwagon, modify the bandwagon, because it will be a different world.
Modify is the key word. Let's talk a little bit about your transition from being an actor. You started as a
manager,
an actor.
Yes, I did. I was kind of never much of an actor, but I had no other goal. So I thought, okay, I had a chance to go into a play that was happening off Broadway in 1967 called McBird.
Oh, I remember that.
Oh yeah. Now I was in that show for a year.
What were you doing up until that time?
When you finished
college, what were your goals?
I finished Brooklyn College, and I had no goals at all. I went into Brooklyn College pre-med, thinking as a nice Jewish boy in Brooklyn, I should be a doctor. Then after my first year's grades, I realized I can't get into a med school. So I demoted myself from my sophomore year to become pre-dent.
Why couldn't you get into med school?
No grades.
Ah, okay. All right.
So pre-dent, once again, I still had no grades because I had no ability for science. So at one point in the beginning of my junior year, by this point, I got called into a meeting with my organic chemistry professor and my physics professor. And they looked at me and said, listen, you're a nice kid. And if you promise us you will never go into the sciences, we will let you out of our class, give you a passing grade, and say goodbye. And I took the deal. The only place that would get me out in the 4 years, because at that time I'm living in my family's apartment, three-bedroom apartment where I share a bed with my 16-year-old brother. So you had to get out after 4 years. So if speech and theater gave me a degree. So
sounds like a Neil Simon play.
Yes, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got the degree, but I still had no goals. I worked for the Bureau of Child Welfare. That nearly destroyed my soul. That was such a tough job with people abusing their children or children having to be taken away from parents. I got out of that in 9 months, went to Berkeley, got married to get out of Vietnam, came back to the East Coast. And that's when I got connected with an old friend of mine, Roy Levine, who was directing the show called McBird. So he said, would I like to be assistant stage manager? Having nothing else to do and no income whatsoever, I jumped at it. And I said, sure, I'll do it. And I played a few bit roles. But I thought, and I started to work up on different roles. I played Teddy Kennedy for a while. I played a number of people. And then I realized at some point it all fell apart for me. I had these phenomenal actors in this show. At that time, Stacy Keach, Bill Devane, Rue McClanahan, Cleavon Little, just to begin, and the rest of them. And I realized at that point, oh my heavens, I'm in trouble. I'm not going to make it as an actor. These guys know what they're doing. The difference was palpable. I couldn't. And I began to love actors for that reason, because I could understand, one, the gift that they have, and two, how to leave them alone so they could exercise their gift. And that was my key thing that made my whole career work, was that somehow I understood actors and I let them play and I learned when to shut my big mouth and not tell them things. And I learned when it was time to step in and say, wait a second, guys, I think we've just gone a little bit over the, that kind of thing. So I just had to learn how to work with actors, and that became my my whole being was my ability. I was an actor's director, you know.
Joel, what's your Hebrew name? Yoel?
No, it's Yaakov.
Yaakov.
Yeah, Yaakov.
Oh,
Yaakov Koppel.
Or Yaki. We can call you Yaki.
Yeah, but some reason my parents wanted to Americanize it into Joel. And I always thought but no, it was Yaakov.
Yeah, that's interesting because my Hebrew name is Mordechai, which should be Mark, but my mother didn't want Mark. So I'm still Mordechai in Hebrew, but Mike or Michael, she liked the name Michael better.
Actually, my dad was a Mark.
Well, you know, what you just said is something that I learned 3 years ago. I knew it, but the first time I directed my feature film, it was a film about the Six-Day War.
Fabulous film, by the way. Let me put in a plug for that film.
Thank you. Thank you. Azimut, about two soldiers, an Israeli and a Egyptian, who meet after the war. But what I knew as an actor, it really came to fruition for me as a director, and it's what you just said. The key is finding the right people as a director and then letting them do what they do best.
It's all about, I tell people my great strength is I really know how to cast.
Stay back. Yeah, it's all about casting. If you cast the right people,
stay back
and let them do their job.
Everybody else also, it goes to the entire crew. It goes to the set designers and the lighting designers. The best people want to be given a chance to be the best they can be. They're not interested in my opinion of how they should do their job. The stories that tell Steven Spielberg doesn't bring in the guy who conducted the Boston Pops for years.
John Williams.
Yes, right. But doesn't bring John Williams to see a movie and then say, gives you the tune to hum. Now, this is the theme I'd like you to use for the movie, and then proceed. That doesn't happen. He knows this John Williams. He sends him off, gets him working.
And you see the results on the screen.
Woo-hoo-hoo, do you ever?
And vice versa, you know. Yeah. So that was the greatest lesson I learned. And I think the other thing is, when you come from from a perspective of an actor, you know how you would like to be treated by a director.
Very much so. There's no question that actors, usually, if they got the other chops necessary, can make the best directors. There's no question about that. Or if they can learn the rest of the skills or something to catch them up with areas of the business that they haven't been operating in, they do make the best directors because they really know how to work with actors.
And you get treated with respect.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. Treat someone with respect and you'll get the best results from them. And so let's talk a little bit about how you went from the stage to being one of the, premier.
I gotta go from La Mama to Laverne and Shirley. Is that
yeah,
what you're...
Yeah. I mean, yeah. God bless you. Over, 40 years that you have?
Wesley, I came out to Hollywood in 1978. So, I don't know, 42 years, is it? Something like that?
Yeah,
I don't know. The math beats me up. Essentially, I was working at La Mama. And I put in 5, 6, 7 years doing avant-garde theater. One of my plays got to Broadway, gave me a Tony nomination. Then all of a sudden, people were hiring me to direct musicals like Shenandoah with John Raitt, Shenandoah with Howard Keel. I did Oklahoma for Christine Andreas and had quite a little run with that. But I was teaching at the time, and I was teaching at Queens College. And one of my students, connections, starts working with my theater company in New York. Sure enough, he has two friends who bring him out to Hollywood because they remember him from Queens College. What a funny little Italian. They brought him out to play some character roles. Greg gets himself established. I'm traipsing around the country doing my musicals when all of a sudden I have 2 weeks free and I decide I'm flying to L.A. to visit Greg. So I get to L.A. to visit Greg. And Greg is doing Busting Loose at that time, which was a show starring Adam Arkin, Alan's kid. So I'm hanging around for 2 weeks, going to the stage, watching what's going on. And it was fascinating because the cast would come at the end of every scene to ask me for notes. They weren't even talking to their own director. They were just coming up to the stand and saying, did you have any notes? So Greg decided I should direct an episode of a sitcom. And I, of course, was a theater director at that time, so I wasn't going to dabble in meaningless sitcoms. But essentially, I finally decided, listen, man, one of my other rules is go for it. You do not turn down things unless you have something else of equal merit someplace else. You don't turn down things. You take the open door and you do the best you can do and try to impress everybody in that new room you've just entered that you've got the goods. And maybe that'll take you to somebody who will take you to someplace else, who will take you someplace else.
And you never know. You
know if you're there. So I went in and I got, I convinced using my Brooklyn Jewish chutzpah, I convinced Paramount to let me direct an episode of Busting Loose by simply saying this. I walked into the lady who was in charge of hiring. I said to her, Judy, I have never directed a sitcom. So I'm not going to stand here and tell you I know how to direct a sitcom. But I've been watching for 2 weeks now. And in my estimation, a retarded monkey can direct a sitcom. I said, the actors, they know the roles. The writers know what they're doing. The cameramen know pretty much where to point. They're not going to point it at me. I said, if I can talk to writers and I can talk to actors, you ought to give me a shot. Called up. I had an episode in a week.
And you had not, as far as the technical aspect,
never.
The camera work, you'd never...
I studied it for 2 weeks. And right. Luckily, I happened to be a systems person. That's my greatest strength. I systematize things exceptionally well. So if there's a system I'm looking at, I can pretty well break down the system and usually find a way to make that system work more efficiently or certainly quicker, which is a big thing in money talks in that industry. You got to get that job done.
And you're talking basically, what you're saying is logic.
It's yes.
Logic.
It's logic.
Basically logic.
How you perceive of things. I put things into a system. I say, oh, right. This is how the coverage goes. And this is how this thing is. And this person's responsible for that. And that person's responsible for that. And I can put that package together relatively easily. It's just a skill I have. And if so, for me, then after that, it's just all process. I just have to keep everything in the moment. And my belief is if you do the best process, you will inevitably come out with the best work.
And you can basically apply that to any profession.
Yes, you can. Anybody leading.
Yeah. Looking at things, make it, and taking a look at what's going on and organizing it and just yes. processing it logically, you can get to I do that if something breaks down in the house, you know, I'm not a plumber. But if I look at things and I say, why is this not working? And just analyze it and-
You're right, that's logic.
And take it apart.
Yeah.
You can find the solution. By the way, we haven't mentioned your book. I read your book.
My book, yes.
Yes. And I don't, forgive me, I don't remember the title.
Directing the sitcom.
Right.
Joel Zwick.
It's all there.
It's the same thing, the same concept. You're right.
Exactly. It's all there. I highly recommend it to any friends of mine who are watching.
It's basically my statement about how one leads right. at any time in life that you are being set up as the leader, how you allow people to be the best they can be, how you set the environment so that they can have fun and they can still grow and they're willing to take chances, and how you have to be the best audience for actors the first time they're up there. If they're doing a comedy and you're sitting there stone-faced, not laughing at anything they're doing, you're in desperate trouble. You know, I had two goals. I never used a script. That's an interesting thing. Never worked with a script. I'd read the script and I would put myself under the duress of learning it beat by beat, not line by line. But I understood the movement of every piece of movement in that show by reading it about two times at night. And I never held a script because I wanted to be with the actors. I wanted to be with them, looking at them, talking to them, and that's it. And I figured if they missed a line, let the script supervisor inform them.
Just the progression of where it's going.
Just the progression of where it's going.
It's all about a story. I mean,
Bingo.
If there's no story, there's nothing. It's like, you know, I say an architect that's about to put up a building, if the structure and the basic is not there,
you get the building.
The building is going to collapse. We are storytellers. That's what we do.
We are storytellers. Yes, we are. And we want to make sure the story is the clearest and cleanest we can. And we want to make sure that the people who work on it become a team that's going to be able to find that story and let it go, you know. But it's interesting. It's tricky stuff. But the fact is that people tend to be oriented one way or the other. An awful lot of directors are technically oriented.
You've worked with so many talented people who have gone on ultimately to become major.
I know.
In our industry. Can you think of any time you have had negative experiences with the people you've worked with, or have you always been able to arrange an atmosphere that should be positive and fruitful?
I work with my attitude in place, and usually part of my casting situation is I tend to work with actors who like me, who will play with me, who will, will engage in my idiocy or insanity or whatever you want to call it. And I test that in an audition also, as well as testing their craft. Because usually 10 actors will show up, 9 of them will have sufficient craft to play the role. My decision has to come not based on craft. It has to come based on how many people really seem to be enjoying playing with me in this audition.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I tend to do is not just playing, it's that I believe that every actor brings to a role his own soul. And your soul will be different than Mr. B's soul, than Mr. A's soul, than Mr. X's soul. So I'm interested when I watch 10 people do the same scene, which actor's soul best represents what I believe that character could possibly be. Not that he was, because the actor will bend that character a bit into his own abilities, you know, into his own ego-centric stuff. So that's what I do. I make sure that they're players. They want to play. If they don't want to play as actors, they don't want to be working with me.
You know, and I also found when I was casting the film, there's a certain chemistry, that something's a je ne sais quoi, you know, something you can't put your finger on it, but it's something that happens. It's a feeling you get, and you can't create it. It's just something you feel right away. And I also learned many years ago that one bad apple can spoil a whole bunch.
Oh, easily. But you know, at various times in your career, you have the power to be able to keep away those bad apples, so to speak. And then you can lose it. You know, it's a question of how much you want to pay. What kind of level of game do you want to be involved in? If you want to do major motion pictures, you're going to be under the duress of casting people from the networks, from the here, from the there. Everybody's got their 2 cents that they're going to try to put in. And very rarely do you get a chance to exercise your own creative input without being pushed around. And I had that. The reason why my Big Fat Greek Wedding turned out so well, besides an immensely talented cast, was the fact that Tom wouldn't let anybody give notes. Hanks was strong enough with that little $5 million budget to basically say to HBO and to this one, I'm sorry, but we're running with this ourselves, and your stunt casting sounds like a good idea, but we're going to let them cast what they want to cast because they see in the roles. And, there's no question in my mind that if we couldn't control casting, I don't know where that movie would have gone, because that ensemble found it, and they found it fast.
But that's mazel, you know.
Yeah, that's mazel.
To have that kind of clout that gives you the freedom, the artistic.
That's for a $5 million. Even Tom had that kind of clout on a $100 million movie. But on a $5 million movie that's supposed to be an indie, it's not supposed to mean much anywhere, whatever it's going to do, just get it out in the theater somehow and see what goes.
You know, what I also learned very quickly on my film was that the director also has to be a little bit of a psychiatrist and a psychologist.
Oh, yeah.
And you're dealing with human beings, not just actors. Each one has his ego. Each one has his problems. And if something, you know, crops up on the set, it's up to you. I mean, because the buck stops there.
The buck stops here.
The buck stops there. You are the one. Sometimes you just have to be a gentle parent to someone, or a brother, or
listen. No question about it. There's relationships, especially in TV, that are questionable. I remember that Alex Karras and Susan Clark, who they had their show taken away from them and given by the network to a little boy named Emmanuel Lewis, and they called the show Webster. Now, that had first been created as a pilot, which I shot, called Another Ball Game. Supposed to be about Alex Karras leaving football and becoming an announcer. Then they saw a commercial starring Emmanuel Lewis, and somebody got the idea, woo, what if they had to adopt one of his ball player friends? So then they changed the title to And Then Came You. And now at this point, Alex and Susan are getting just a little upset. And then when they finally changed it to the kid's name, Webster, there were some questionable things that would go on set, but mostly between the two of them. They were not nice to Emmanuel, but not outrageous. But they would get into fight. I had one scene that was one of the best ever. They had a fight at night. They were married, and I didn't know about their fights at night. What do I care? I got a scene to do. So there's a scene where Alex is supposed to walk into Susan's office and do a half a page scene and leave. So he gets up to the scene, and Alex says, I'm not going into that woman's office. I said, what do you mean, Alex, you're not going to that woman's office? The script says, you walk into that office, you do this scene. And he says, well, I'm not going to that office. If she wants to talk to me, you tell her to come into my office. So I go over to Susan and say, Susan, come on. Now, you're the adult in this group. Would you please go into his office and do the scene? She said, it's written that he comes into my office to do the scene. We will do it in my office. You know how I did the scene? On the phone. I had him in his office call her in her office, and they did the scene on the phone. You do have to times that you have to kind of conjure up things, because if you're going to be intense work, at some point it can turn, especially you're the two-man thing. One's playing an Arab, one's playing an Israeli. They're at each other's throats. They're hiding behind walls. They're thinking of shooting each other. But the fact remains that that's intense stuff that's going on. You know, so you don't find that much about how that chemistry is going to work until they're really working it.
With just two characters. That was a challenge, but I was very lucky in that I had two
really good casting, really
good professional people.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things I learned as a kid, I'd rather work with a lesser talent who is a pro than one of these great, geniuses, but is not a professional. Professionalism is the most important thing. You find a pro that you work with, you can do anything you want. But there's so
pretty
many,
much,
you know, great talents that will give you the biggest problem on a
production. Well, to be quite honest, little by little, that's breaking down in our industry, because the industry won't tolerate it anymore. They just won't put up with it. The industry is working at a different rate. Different people are determining how our industry works. We're driven by business much more than we ever have. So therefore, at that point, if it's business, if somebody's going to, Al Pacino doing 65 takes on a movie because he didn't bother to learn his lines, that's not happening anymore. Now Mr. Pacino is on a television series, and I can tell you that churning that out is a lot. They're not doing 65 takes on Pacino until he figures out what kind of a character he wants to play. So the business is modifying itself, and that's a good thing. That really is a good thing, that a lot of that highfalutin stardom. You know where the stardom is now? It's in celebrity. And celebrities are not necessarily talented. They have one talent. They know how to sell themselves.
We are living in a celebrity society.
Very much so.
Unfortunately, more than ever. I mean, it always was that way in a way, but now it's more than ever, because any celebrity today with an iPhone has his own show.
Yeah. Or people from, listen, when we were getting into this business, for me, that we had two networks in New York. There was no work came out to California. There were three networks. There was, you know, maybe 15 television comedies being done at that time. That's not a lot of work. Nowadays, people can prove their wares on YouTube. People can make short films here or there. People can dream all over the country. I didn't have any dreams. Brooklyn, New York was much too far away from Manhattan, never mind.
You're going across the bridge. Yeah.
I've got to tell you, you had to make a commitment. You had to bring a sandwich with you. You had to have some food with you to get on the subway.
Subway, yes.
And make it all the way into Midtown Manhattan. It wasn't happening too often.
I want to ask you about one particular star that you worked with that we lost tragically a few years ago,
Robin.
That was the beginning of his, basically, the beginning of his great
run. Yeah.
Rise to fame.
Yeah, because he was working as an improv actor around Hollywood, and I think it was called the Off the Wall Company. And everybody in town, the casting agents, they all knew Robin Williams, and nobody would touch him with a 10-foot pole. They were scared of him because of his fluid mind and his ability to go places. Well, they were doing an episode of Happy Days where Mork was coming down to be a foil for Henry Winkler. And they had somebody cast in the role. The name is, but he lasted 2 days when he himself decided, I can't do this role, and left. They were in trouble. They had to go, no, they had to bring in Robin to do Mork. He did it in 3 days. And then Gary Marshall said, oh, this guy's funny. We'll put him together with Pam Dorber. She's cute. And we'll make ourselves a sitcom. And we had Mork and Mindy. But he was, he was two people. I mean, we know that he was, later on, we found out he was suffering from manic depression and all kinds of problems. But basically, if he was on, nobody got near him. Nobody could compete. Nobody had a mind fast enough.
How was it to work with him?
Very good. He was a gentleman at all times. He, to the day that last time I saw him, he still used to call me Mr. Zwick, sir, with a slight nod of the head. Mm-hmm. He was very respectful, and he basically listened to everything anybody said and then go about doing it himself, whatever he chose to do. I taught him the lesson by saying, if you want to go half cock off the top, stay on your mark. We're shooting film. Everything will be lost if you decide this would be a good time to dance over to the counter. You don't have that option, but you can say anything you'd like and we'll worry about it later on, whether it can be put in the show.
What did you prefer or just talk about the difference between tape and film?
Well, film, what did you for the most part, by the time we got to film, we at least had in-lens viewing. We had monitors so we could see what the cameras were doing. But when I started out on Laverne and Shirley, those were the only way you knew you got the shot was that the cameraman said, I got it. If you never saw what it was he was shooting, but you told him at one point what the shot was and you assumed he got it. He said, I got it. And if one guy says, I didn't get it, you go, what you didn't get? And pick it up. But with tape made, it just looked different. Tape represented at that time when it first came out, looked like television news. It looked like reality. It looked like everything was happening, where film still had that magical quality of being make-believe.
Right.
You know? Make-believe. We shot the pilot of Bosom Buddies on film, but the deal was that we'd have to go to tape to do the series. And the difference between the feel, the depth of the pilot, which was on film, and the rest of the series, which, you know, the writing was up to par, everything was going well, except the look had gotten into a very flat TV look.
So, Joel, we can go on and on and on, and we will someday, but let me ask you about the future.
Our future.
What have you got planned?
I work
right
with
now. Yeah, right now we're kind of limited.
I work with Hershey. I do this podcast with you. We're helping an acting class out on Tuesday night online, Zooming. I Zoom with my cousins on my mother's side. That's pretty nifty. We've got cousins that are all closing in on 80 years old. It's hysterical that we're the old guard now. Yeah. There's nobody left. We're the end of it. Now, my thing is I do 5-year plans, and I got another 2 years to go on this 5-year plan, which was that if some project comes up that I think I would have a good time doing, I'm going to do it. However, I'll see what happens when I turn 80, because these years change you. I have a friend who's 84, and it's staggering the difference between what you feel like at 75, 78, 82, 84, and then going on. Now, there's some people who can continue. Maybe when I turn 80, I'll say, I'm going 5 more years. I think I can push this 5 more years and just enjoy myself, do a play here or there, talk to somebody who'd like to be on stage. I think I'll do that for a while. I can't give up. You can't give up the arts. You can't give up passions.
No. You know, my dad, may he rest in peace, he was close to 90, and he was still performing. He would still go up on stage,
God bless him.
You know, sing, and used to whistle. And I said, Dad, you know, come on, you know, why are you doing this? You know, relax a little bit. You've earned it. He said to me in Yiddish, "Der willst du so starben? You want me to die?"
Exactly. I got nothing else.
If I don't do this, I will die. So
essentially, it's in our souls, and that's it. We have to be creative. It's just that at this particular point, the drive to have to be paid for my creativity is not there.
Well, that's a blessing too.
That's a blessing.
It's something you can pick and choose.
That's right. And I think, don't care if I'm being paid.
Yeah. To me, the reaching that goal to me is so important that I can pick and choose. I do things because I want to, not because I have to.
That's right. The have to's, if it's not over by the time we hit 75, you did some strange stuff.
Then we should have
especially
been
since you were so damn talented, you would have really blown it.
Well, look at our friend. You know, I'm going to put up a picture when I broadcast this. Remember, we screened my film for Norman Lear.
For Norman, sure.
We have a picture, the three of us.
Oh yes, I love that picture.
Yes, and Norman is 97. God bless him.
97 now. 97. You see, I refuse to allow them to age. I thought Carl Reiner was still 94, and he turned out to be 98. And you know, the last time I saw him, I thought he was 95. Now, all of a sudden, he jumped 2 years on me.
It's a number, Joel.
It's a number.
Now, I'm going to add one thing I always ask my friends now on this channel that I've started. If I were to ask you for one individual that inspired your life, who would it be?
Wow. There's a deep question. Inspired my life.
Your life or your career?
I would have to say the one person who inspired my life had to be at La Mama, Ellen Stewart, who was the creative director. If there wasn't La Mama, Joel Zwick never becomes a director. And then if that never happens, the rest of the story never gets written that way. So essentially, that was there. It was actually between Ellen Stewart and Andy Robinson who gave me the chance. Andy had written a play. Somebody else was directing it. They didn't like where he was going with it. They brought me in. They said, we want you to direct it. I had never directed anything before. There was no reason for them to believe that I should be able to direct that. But for some reason, survival. I watched TV. I knew what my sense of funny was. I mean, and I just did it with choreography and all. And it traveled Europe and played the West End of London. And I was a director.
It was Bashert.
Bashert, Bashert.
Bashert means it was meant to be.
Something along the way treated me really good.
We don't have all the answers, Joel, but we have to accept what comes our way and be
very much so, and be gracious about it.
Yeah.
And if you can give back or pay it forward or whatever the game is that they now call it, I always thought giving it back was made sense, but paying it forward makes sense too. But anyway. So that's what I do too. You know, I'm involved with La Mama. I'm on their board of directors. I stay heavily involved with them. I'm still heavily involved with Brooklyn College, my alma mater, because I got a free college education, free 4 years, F-R-E-E, $37 a year student fee, nothing else. And you know, I went with Bernie Sanders, and that's where he got the idea. It wasn't like he made this up for himself. I also went to high school with Bernie Sanders. God, he was a year behind me at Madison High School because he didn't make the SP. And he needs to know that he wasn't smart enough to make the SP. But he was a year behind me at Madison High School, which was quite a little center for everything. Carole King was in my class. Yeah. We sang together in a group called the Cosines. And that went on for a while. And Carole introduced me to Roy Levine, who introduced me to McBird, who introduced me to Andy Robinson, who introduced me to La Mama, who introduced me to directing. And there it is. And I just took every opportunity. I was just a hard worker, and I was always a follower. I understood. I was a great follower. I understood what a leader needed. And then all of a sudden, I found myself leading, and it seemed natural. Well, it seemed like at that point, I'd probably earned it. I don't know.
You know, that we are all interconnected. That's really, you know, connections. And the fact that someone is willing to give you a hand, it doesn't always work that way when you need a hand.
That's true.
But I am always the first one, if anyone comes to me and says, can you help me do whatever it is? And I say, why not? It doesn't cost
me. That's exactly right.
It doesn't cost me anything.
Mm-hmm.
I can help someone out. And usually it does work because I'm very lucky. I can pick up a telephone to so many people that I have met.
Yeah, you built up an enormous amount of influential connections, let's say.
And goodwill for some reason. And so people take my phone calls. And mm-hmm. I've helped a lot of young people get started because I think, as you say, give back. You know, we are
at some point, blessed. You just have to do
to give back. And Mike, I'll leave you with my motto, like I always leave my friends. My motto is carpe diem.
Oh.
Seize the day.
Seize the day. This is the same thing. Take the opportunities. You've got to take the opportunities. Don't sit there second guessing opportunities, because the chances are that you're going to miss that opportunity plus the one you thought you were going to get, and you're really in trouble.
And don't sit on the fence. The worst thing is indecision is the worst thing. Make a decision one way or the other. It may be right, it may be wrong, but indecision.
No, people smell indecision and they're not particularly happy with working with people who are not decisive in positions that they're supposed to be decisive, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree with you 100%. Carpe diem indeed.
Carpe diem. Joel, thank you so much. This is really great. A joy. And I'll be putting it up later today on my channel, which Perfect. Is for all of you watching, Mike Burston and Friends on YouTube. Please join us there. You know, come on and, you know, join the register. What is it? What do they say you're supposed to do? You're supposed to sign on. Or
sign on. Whatever.
Whatever. And we'll see you next time. Thank you, Joel
Zwick. Okay, you take it easy.
For joining us.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Carpe diem. Bye-bye.
Carpe diem indeed. I'm leaving. Watch this. Bink.
He's going. Bink. Bye, everybody. See you next time.